Originally, the sole focus of this paper, as has been mentioned several times, was David Lynch, which is why perhaps some of you are questioning why we have the Gross Clinic featured behind us, or rather in front of you. However, it was during the development of this paper that started sometime last fall, or rather winter, that we found ourselves constantly bombarded by information around in the Ghost Clinic, particularly with its post-restoration exhibit at the PMA, and now as it's being presented in the Anatomy Academy exhibit, which is framing the symposium. If we could go back in time and retitle our paper, we would call it 1976 Eraserhead, 1876 The Gross Clinic. And we're, you know, having said that, it's not that, you know, you're going to have to get back your money's worth for what you came to see. We are going to talk about David Lynch, but we do want to, you know, have that in light of a unique precedent, a very unique precedent that came before it 100 years later. We're not trying to simplify either Aiken's The Gross Clinic or David Lynch's Eraserhead for the sake of, you know, a flaky comparison or a simplified, forced artistic genealogy. What we're trying to do is rather, you know, identify the elements in Lynch's Eraserhead regarding the pictured body with Gross Clinic in mind and in front of you. In this case, there are several evident parallels between the two artists. Obviously, both have a home at Paffa and in Philadelphia. Both artists use painting and time-based media. You know, both use painting and photography, and incorporated self-portraiture in the margins of their work. Both the Gross Clinic and Eraserhead faced what could be called lightly a mixed critical reception, right? And both have been examined via the lens of biographic and psychoanalytical interpretation. However, in jointly considering Lynch and Aiken's, what we're going to focus on in this paper is the common denominator, what we consider the determining common denominator between their works. Firstly, the representation of intense corporeal experience, the body and extremis. And secondly, the position of the viewer relative to the pictured body. So let us begin with the Gross Clinic. You know this painting well. The focal points of the painting that have been identified by several Aiken scholars is Gross's hand and the incision. Michael Fried describes both as having this trompe l'oeil illusionism, and he states that it is not just the oozing of an incision, but the pull of the retractors against its sides, the probing of the wound with a long, thin pencil instrument, which makes this viewing experience acutely unpleasant, indeed painful. Both Fried and Aiken scholar Elizabeth Johns highlight the sharp focus of Gross's hand in the incision as heightened by the distortion and the blurring of the elements in the foreground. To step back even a little bit more with regards to the subject matter of being intense corporeality, both in Lynch and Aiken's work that we're seeing here, we need to highlight that this is not, intrinsic corporeality was not a new focus when the Gross Clinic came into view. He had, with his prior series on rowing and unboxing, showed an evident intense interest in corporeality. While Aiken's subject matter reveals his interest in painting themes specific to Philadelphia, it is worth highlighting that in boxing and in rowing, both something that came before and after, or excuse me, rowing coming before and boxing coming after the Gross Clinic, he was choosing something matter that involved intense physical strain. This interest in the body and an extremis highlights perhaps his prior studies in anatomy, both as a student here at Paffa and in France, and his specialized college work for specialized surgical college work at the Jefferson Medical Hospital and Paris hospitals. At the time that he embarked on the Gross Clinic, Aiken's had studied anatomy for 12 years and had been involved in the dissection of cadavers as much as in the observation of surgery. It seems that in representing the body at its corporeal extreme in the Gross Clinic, be it from maximal physical endurance or at its vital limit, Aiken's figuratively represented his scientific pursuit. However, aside from these observations, there are two main reasons why we feel that the Gross Clinic was a compelling element that we wanted to include into this presentation. The first is that it was focused on a contemporary living body, an incision within a contemporary living body. Prior to the Gross Clinic, there are many works where incisions are present. These were often, however, on subject matter that was far removed from the viewer both in time and in space. be it because they were depicting violent historical events, because the subject matter derived more from biblical or mythological references. However, there are also the present of anatomical instruction studies, all dealing with cadavers, where you would have the incision or a body flayed, but none dealing with the contemporary body quite in the same way as the Gross Clinic. Elizabeth Johns, in her Hallmark article, states that the flag, the blood bleeding of the subject, is the flag of the living being on the operating table. It is in depicting the cutting of tissue and positioning the viewer directly in the pit next to surgical tools used to perform this operation, not to mention a public operation, where much of the painting's real estate, if you see, is taken up by the audience, which is kind of dark in this slide, but believe us, it's there. It's as if Aikens was trying to take the viewer as close as possible to what could be the inside of a living person. The second reason, and this ties in with what I just said, that makes the Gross Clinic so compelling is that it's not just as close as possible to the inside of a living person, it's rather that we're suspended in the moment of action where the incision has taken place. We suggest that this suspension is a creative strategy Aikens learned from photography. Photography informed Aikens' painting practice since he came back from Paris in 1870, and sequentiality, the idea of a before and after in a painting, is an artistic concern since his rowing series, and this we're particularly indebted to Kathy Foster, who have talked about it, this subject with us at length. Aikens had correspondence with his mentor in Paris, Jerome, regarding earlier versions of some of the paintings in his painting series, in the rowing series, where he asked, or where there was discussion of what, whether to paint a rower in mid-arc or before or after the arc was completed. Obviously, sequentiality was also an interest for Aikens in his forays into motion photography, which started in 1878 at the University of Pennsylvania, both with Edward Muybridge, who had preceded him with his photographs of horses in motion, but also on his own with a camera that he himself invented. While for the most part Aikens did not continue his integration of motion into photography after 1880, the Gross Clinic is at a cusp between his representation of motion in painting and his exploration of motion through photography. At a time when painting was coming to grips with photography as a means of image making, the Gross Clinic was somewhat of a litmus test for realist painting of the figure, not only in representing a contemporary living body at its physical limit, but also in arresting the exact moment in which that was taking place in a way that was conceivable through photography. This effect of the Gross Clinic is described by Michael Fried as the new and stupefyingly powerful experience of the real in this painting, which he says Aikens resorted to tactics of shock, violence, perceptual distortion, and physical outrage. This description lends itself to frame the patient and the viewer's experience as one of pain. We, however, wish to posit another interpretation in that, as I already mentioned, the idea of presenting the incision or the body at that limit, Aikens was not trying to emphasize pain visually, but rather bring the viewer as close as possible to the inside of a living body. And we know that this is somewhat of a stretch, but in terms of who, the art historical analysis that we're latching on to make this claim, we focused on James Elkins' book, Pictures of the Body, Pain and Metamorphoses. And Elkins presents an alternative definition of pain, one that does not denote aching or throbbing, or even unpleasantness of any sort, but one that captures the nonverbal experience of sensation in varying degrees of intensity. Hence, pain can be comparable, if you will, to the general condition of being alive. Additionally, Elkins suggests that pain is comparable to the neurological concept of proprioception, or the body's internal sense of itself. In contrasting pain as that embodied experience, Elkins delineates a second term, which we'll be also using in the second part of this paper, which is metamorphosis, that he relegates to all visual representations of the body. Whereas pain is the experience of being inside the body, metamorphosis exists by looking alone, as images that elicit the analytic side of seeing through metaphor and allegory or through graphic simplification. For Elkins, confining embodiment to all its embodiment, to all its senses, is strictly a distortion. By confining all the senses to strictly the visual, you are carrying out a distortion. So by conferring embodiment only a visual aspect, it is basically a way of altering the idea of translating a body from an experience of embodiment to paper or to any other surface, which makes a complete change in form, appearance, or condition. It is in this understanding of pain and metamorphoses, in these two categories, which basically we frame our comparison of the Gross Clinic and Eraserhead. In the Gross Clinic, the incision is a way into a personhood or a living body just beneath the surface. In Eraserhead, incisions are the moments in which the body faces the most drastic and irretrievable changes of form, be it birth, injury, or death. The representation of these moments, in which the body is at its limit between one corporeal form and another, heightens the sense of being in the body, and it is as if in making Eraserhead, Lynch understood Elkin's claim that visual representations are distortions, and that to get a heightened sense of rupture in the body is a way of representing a fuller sensorial range of embodiment. I'll leave you with this frame, and Anna Mulbermeyer is going to read the second part of the paper, Eraserhead, on Eraserhead.
Okay. Perhaps it is for this reason that one of the first reviews of Eraserhead concluded that the film needed to be experienced rather than explained. In light of this apt preamble, it is clear that the film needs to be understood in its entirety, not privileging any one section over another. This reading of Eraserhead resists rigid delineations into the realms of fantasy, dream, hallucination, and the representational real. The film does not allow the viewers to draw discernible lines. In fact, any attempt to normalize the narrative of Eraserhead is rhythmically interrupted and continually contradicted by the merging of the film's environments into one another. And here I'm going to go through, there's the atmospheric void, the exterior landscape, which is almost solely inhabited by the character of Henry, the main character of the film, throughout the film. The interior of Henry's apartment, and the space of Henry's dreams or fantasies, which, you know, that's obviously his dreams and fantasies, setting the terms for viewing Eraserhead as his own self-referential unit. Indeed, the world created with an Eraserhead is intensely hermetic, both in the sense that in the film's five-year production, Lynch literally lived on the film site, working with a small group of people to bring the film to fruition, and in the sense that the Kafkaesque realm in which Henry exists is exclusively, entirely the reality of Eraserhead. So Henry is Eraserhead, Eraserhead is Henry. It is for this reason that we do not place a fixed meaning or final narrative account on the film, but rather identify the primary visual and corporeal moments within the film that create what Rodley describes as the film's strange sensory power. Our presented stills and video clips fall into two groups. The first involve acts of seeing, which take forms of Henry seeing, images of what Henry sees, the seeing of Henry through the eyes of another character, which we chose this because we would argue that Henry being seen is always Henry seeing himself. The second are bodily metamorphoses, or moments of irretrievable changing of form, which are materialized both in the character of Henry and his offspring, which for the sake of clarity, we're going to refer to as the baby, the seed, because all of them are one, but this is the seed. This is the seed again, and I guess you showed the baby first, right? Okay. The first 10 minutes of Eraserhead frame seeing and metamorphosis as the viewer's entry point to the film. To properly begin speaking about Eraserhead, it is necessary to introduce Henry as Lynch does. Amid the ambient and empty rushing sound of the film's first moments, the image of Henry's cropped face appears, shown in intense observation, and floating impossibly above the backdrop of the black atmospheric void. As his head joins with and hovers over the single visible planet that exists in the empty sky, Henry opens his mouth as if to speak, and the character of the baby, the seed, emerges from his mouth. From this ethereal environment, the baby, the seed, drops into a pool of water, which transforms eventually into a tunnel that leads us to the surface of the planet and through the multiple landscapes, only to bring us back to Henry, staring. This opening sequence and his entry into Henry is echoed by another moment in the film where one of the many manifestations of the baby, the seed, burrows into and reemerges from the rough surface of the planet. The baby, the seed, cries and he opens its mouth. The camera follows into the sort of aperture, this right here. We go into the mouth of the seed as it cries, and we reappear along with Henry. In the next slide, this is where we come back out of Henry with his back turned to us, sitting in his apartment. These two moments, as well as others throughout the film, suggest to the viewer that each exit is also an entry. As previously implied, seeing an Eraserhead always comes back to Henry. One of the most frequent images in the film is, like our first still, an image of Henry staring. What Henry is absorbed in seeing often remains unknown, and although we encounter his furrowed brow and intensely concerned eyes, his gaze is more inwardly reflective than outwardly peering at the viewer. Throughout the film, instances of Henry seeing are presented alongside images of what Henry sees, shot from nearly first-person perspective. We see the detail of Henry's hands, and actually you can't really see this, but this is directly after we see the back of his head. So we go to first-person shot right after having gone through that tunnel. The highly textured surface of the exterior landscape, and most importantly, the character of the baby, the seed, through and framed by Henry's eyes. And this is the eye of the baby looking at Henry. The seeing of Henry through the eyes of another character is less frequent throughout the film and notably occurs in flashes. The audience is aware that Henry is being looked at by the way in which Lynch rhythmically shifts from a close image of Henry's eyes to the eyes of another character. This is particularly evident between Henry and the baby, in addition to other characters which we won't discuss because of the length of the paper, such as the man in the planet, the lady in the radiator, and the beautiful girl across the hall, for those of you who've seen the film. In each framing, sight always brings us back to Henry, which is getting a little repetitive at this point. If seeing an Eraserhead serves metaphorically as a passageway, metamorphoses in turn are ruptures experienced within and created by Henry. These corporeal transformations also serve as passages between the visible exterior of the body and the invisible within, which brings us to our two video clips, both of which represent a death, and they're rather graphic. In the first, Henry is beheaded by the baby, the seed, as it pushes from inside of his body. And at this point, I'm going to show video clip one. Okay, if we can go back to the PowerPoint presentation for just a few slides. And so, as we saw, the decapitated head is sucked through the stage floor and dropped into the exterior landscape. And at this point, it gets picked up by the child, brought into a room, drilled into by two men, and mechanically processed into pencils. And then the eraser dust from the pencils is dispersed after the man writes with it. He uses Henry's head to erase some marks on a page and sweeps it away. The scenes are really close in proximity, and we wanted to give you a lead into the second clip before just jumping right to it. But pretty much that's all that happens in between clip one and clip two, so we'll show video clip two now. So, yeah. Henry cuts open to the bandages that contain and enclose the baby's body. And I'm going to let Anna get to the point where we were at. And that's the last video still, or the last video clip. So the rest is stills. He stabs its internal organs with a scissor. The perforation causes the baby's interior to erupt, and everything just spews all over the interior of the apartment. So I spared you that, at least. If you thought that was graphic, then you didn't have to see the entire space of the apartment be consumed. The seed fades into a blinding light that, when cleared, brings us to the end of the scene and within minutes of the conclusion of the film. And Henry appears suspended once again in the atmospheric space of the film's opening scene. This time the viewer identifies the stars or the atmospheric void as the eraser dust as previously seen. The sequences of decapitation and stabbing are decisively similar. In each, the bodily exterior gives way to rupture, not only revealing what lies beneath the surface, but bringing about an irreversible change within the characters of the baby and Henry. These two scenes, arguably the peak moments of Eraserhead, create the feeling of suspension in the viewer. However, this is not the same suspension reproduced in the Gross Clinic, which relies on fixity or capturing a definitive spatio-temporal moment in the representation of the body and extremis. Lynch accomplishes suspension through protraction of the very moment of rupture. The absence of dialogue and the extended length of both scenes, and the film itself is a very long film. It feels very protracted, and these scenes have the most intense sort of moments, and they still feel long, and the viewer is very anxious during these two scenes, obviously. Lynch accomplishes suspension through protraction of the very moment of rupture. The absence of dialogue and the extended length of both scenes center the viewer's attention on the simultaneity of visual details and events. Furthermore, the proximity of the scenes in the film and the way in which they mirror one another collapses the past and the present, causing the timeline of the film to turn inward upon itself, looping back cyclically and in continual motion. That the stabbing scene picks up where the end of the decapitation leaves off, and that the film's final shot brings us back to the opening scene, only emphasize these points. In the cyclical aspect of Eraserhead, where the scene of a death merges into one of birth, where exits, our entries, and categorical definitions collapse, perhaps the only aspect of the film that can be emphatically asserted is the emphasis in traversing, or changing, as a visual experience. If we could expand the argument of this paper, our reading of Eraserhead as Henry and Henry as Eraserhead would perhaps lead to a discussion of the way in which phenomenology and ontology merge in the film. However, that would require an extension of our discussion beyond embodiment, beyond of just the sense of being in a body, to account for things like the relationship between, senses, perception, emotion, and intention. Which brings us to the conclusion of our paper. If the Gross Clinic presents an incision as a way into the living body of a person, an Eraserhead is the passing through incision which approaches a representation of the interior corporeal experience. The Gross Clinic statically captures the body in extremis. Eraserhead uses metamorphosis as a foil for continuous flux of sensory information. Both Thomas Aikens and David Lynch present the cutting of flesh as the visual entry point into the body. If the Gross Clinic gives us the pictured body, Eraserhead, in turn, gives us the pictured embodiment. Thanks.